Hi, everybody. I'm Wendy Murdoch, and this is Webinars with Wendy. I've been doing a series of webinars, and we're in March. I think we're going to come up on 2 years of doing this. So it's just amazing the people that you meet when you travel out and about. When I was at Ecoin Affair in Massachusetts, across the aisle from me was Piper Klem, and we got to talking, and I was just fascinated by all the things she's doing for the horse world and for women in particular, I think. So I was really excited to have her come on as a guest. So thank you, Piper, for joining me today on this really snowy holiday day.
Thank you for having me.
It's great. Where you are, it's not snowy though. Apparently you're in California right now. And so that's, completely different weather than what we're having.
Yep. I just got out here and I come to the horse shows in their mall for the winter, most winters. So it's a nice change of pace from upstate New York.
Oh, yeah. Is that where you're from? Is upstate New York? For sure. Yeah. So you missed all this lovely weather. Good for you. So Piper, tell us, give us your background, because the little bit of your bio I read, the PhD in chemistry, I am so fascinated to learn about how you got where you are and what you're doing. And it seems like you're doing so many things. So I'm really looking forward to learning more about what you are up to.
Well, I grew up horse crazy and my parents are non-horse people. They found my first barn in the yellow pages of the phone book and knew nothing about what we were getting into. And I navigated my way the best I could. And I didn't see a lot of opportunities. I didn't see a lot of pathways. I worked really hard, but I didn't really develop the coping skills I needed to be successful in the sport. And I never really felt that welcomed in the sport. I went on, I was told there are no jobs in horses, like most people. So I went on to do the academic thing. My horse skills served me so well. I think my success in academia, and I tell this to parents all the time, my success in academia came from the skills I learned at the barn of just, really attacking challenges head on, waking up every day and working on long-term projects. Without any semblance of whether they may or may not be successful, and not getting discouraged by that. And so I was very successful in school. I finished first in my class at University of California, Berkeley with my PhD when I was 24. And a little bit like the horse thing, like I really pushed and pushed and pushed and burned myself out. And by the end of grad school, I'd pushed and pushed and pushed and burned myself out. And, I didn't know what was next or what I wanted to do. I wanted to come back to the horse community and instantly recognize that, like, as unwelcome as I felt as a child, I felt even more unwelcome as an adult. I felt, like people made comments about my weight and it was, oh, you can't do this, or you don't have the money for that, or, and there were just so many barriers that just didn't need to be there. And I'd gotten a little bit involved with the media side of science during my PhD. And so I just slowly started to realize that I had a voice and I could share things. And I started writing a little bit for publications, just as I was going to horse shows, and watching and easing my way back in. And I was like, I hit a point where like people weren't letting me say what I wanted to say or do what I wanted to do. And I was like, I need my own thing, 'cause I don't want to listen to these people. And
you were in the hunter world, right?
Yep. In the hunter world. And so within a year of kind of coming back to the sport, I ended up buying the plaid horse. I didn't know who owned it. I cold called around. I was able to buy it on a mortgage from the previous owner. So I made a down payment and made monthly payments until it was paid off.
So the plaid horse was a publication already?
Yep. Okay. It didn't have much online presence or social media. It was a print publication, newspaper print. On the East Coast, and it had started in 2003.
Okay. And where did it get the name?
Just from the Baker blankets and seeing, the plaid horses in their stalls all over the place. So.
Okay. Yeah. Because I've always been curious about where the name came about, and I didn't realize that you didn't start it. So it was in existence in 2003. Is that what you said?
Yep.
Okay. And then you bought it when?
2014.
Okay. So 11 years later.
Yep.
But it was just you said it in a newspaper style.
Yep. Newspaper print. And, it came out irregularly and So, but it had people that loved it. And the feel I always loved about it, it was a magazine for everyone. And it was the place that people were often in their first ever time in a horse magazine was in the Plaid Horse. And that's something that I've really strived to keep to this day is like the excitement of like seeing yourself in print for the first time ever. We have that every single issue. Every issue we have grandparents calling, ordering more copies, like people, you know, amateurs like ordering copies to send to their childhood trainer, you know, like, and I love that. I love that every issue has that same excitement of the first time. And I don't think many publications get that.
No, usually it's kind of the same old people. And, you know, in my experience writing for different magazines, it's really hard to break into a magazine to become an author in a particular magazine, like really difficult. Once you're in, it seems like, you know, you can keep going, but getting in is always difficult. So you bought the Plaid Horse and then what?
I want to say that I just want to dispel that rumor quick before we go through. We have this link and I just put it in the chat, the Plaid Horse, right for us. If you ever, we read every single submission that comes in. And if you ever have an issue or something or an experience you want to talk about, a lot of our bloggers are, you know, one-time writers or people who have one thing that they want to get across or one thing that they're not seeing in print. So if you see an experience that you have that you're not seeing represented, like, come join us. And we have this platform and directions to jump right in.
Oh, that's so awesome.
Yeah.
Okay. So 2014, you buy this magazine and then what do you do?
So the magazine was profitable, not very profitable, but not losing money. And so the first thing, and I had no, like, I had thought I wanted to do a website. I really didn't know anything about print magazines. And like, I didn't read anything into it when I called her and asked if she would sell. And she said, yes. And so the whole deal happened really quickly. I mean, it was the timing was right for both of us. And so literally from like the day I called her to like owning the magazine was like 5 weeks, including all the due diligence and everything. Yeah. It was so fast. And then it was like a dog chasing a car. Like you catch the car and then what? So like now I own a magazine and I'm like, my first year, everyone is telling me to like do this and do that and do that. And I was like, no, until I understand the business, I can change nothing. So the only thing I changed the first year was I added social media. I added the website, you know, and I got us going on Instagram and Facebook and, you know, Pinterest and Twitter and all the social medias and started to get content out there. And I started to get the website rolling a little bit more, but not too much.
Were you working really, another job all the time you're doing this?
So I graduated and then I was still doing a little bit. I was like editing science textbooks and stuff at night and doing some scientific writing. But the way things worked in my life is that we lived in California and then my husband got a tenure track position at St. Lawrence University in upstate New York, which is like the dream job and very statistically unlikely. And so it was one of those, like, it was a perfect thing for him. We had to move, but we were moving to somewhere with such a low cost of living that like it lessened our financial pressures as
from California couple. For sure.
Yeah. So I was able to have a little bit of lead time where like, I didn't need to bring in income that day to like survive. And like, things were hard and we lived very, very cheaply, but you know, it afforded me that time to figure it out a little bit. And I'm really grateful for that. So I was working a little bit freelance for some horse publications and doing that stuff. I have a pony leasing business that I was still running at that time. So I had like here and there, it wasn't going to sustain me for a long time, but I had enough like here and there income coming in to like keep the projects afloat and so, have a little bit of time to figure it out.
What I just want to point out is, you had multiple balls in the air.
Oh yeah, always.
Right.
Yeah.
That's what I kind of gather from you is that you had a lot of things in the air, but you know, because some people think that when you start a business like this, you have to like stop everything else or, you know, have a big financial backing to do things. And what I love, one of the things I love about your story is you just dive in and you make it work and cobble together whatever you have to get this project going because you saw the value in it. And I just, you know, one of the things I love about my guests is the inspiration they provide to my viewers. And just listening to you, I was like, that's one of the things I really wanted to know about is, you know, how, because you're not that old.
I think I wrote for other horse magazines for like the first 4 years still. because, you know, I'd go to a horse show or I'd go to some place where I knew that they didn't have coverage or they didn't have a person. And I'd reach out to like other horse magazines and be like, I'm going to be at this horse show. Do you want me to write your press releases too? And awesome. Yeah. So like, and again, like it's, you know, I try to get along with everyone. I try to work with everyone. I don't think we're competitive in the horse industry. I don't view any magazines as my competition. I think people should read as much as they can. I think they should learn as much as they can. And I think every group provides a different viewpoint and a different perspective and a different, you know, style to their content. And I think there's a place for everyone. Yeah. So I don't want, you know, other people to go out of, I think if they went out of business, it would devalue me, you know? And so I sit here and like, print, if I can help them out, I will. And, right. And some of them do for me and some of them don't, but it's on them.
Yeah. Because, you know, I was looking at the 2022 American Horse Council directory and I got it years and years ago. And the number of equine publications that are listed is like so drastically fewer than, I mean, it used to be pages and pages and now it's a couple of pages. So, you know, the print is not an easy modality these days because of so much online. And so I love your attitude of there's a place for everybody. And you have taken this from a newspaper. So the first year you didn't change it, but then obviously you have. And now it's this incredibly beautiful glossy magazine. And I don't know if you have a copy there to hold up so people can see how pretty it is.
I don't. I pass all of them out. That's one of my, I will hand to people like my last whatever. And then, so I'm waiting for the new issue to ship out here. But yeah, so.
Yeah. Okay. So when did you start making changes and what were the changes you made?
We went all glossy in January 2016. And then a lot of the changes have been hiring and then upgrading those hires. You know, in the beginning, it was basically me. And then as we've gone, we've hired people. And then as we've gone more, we've been able to hire more quality people. I think one of the hardest things in this industry is that there are a lot of people who, like, how do I say this, have never had a real job before, and so do fail to understand employment expectations. But in the beginning, they're kind of all you can hire. And so I went out and did this because I never, like, in hindsight, I never wanted to be a boss. Like, I wanted my own company so that no one told me what to do, but I had no interest in telling someone else what to do. And so those conversations, those boundaries, those expectations, I mean, that's been so hard for me. And we really grew from a place where we had nothing and like we're desperate. And like now we're not desperate anymore, but changing those interactions with people and changing how I deal with people, that's been really hard and really hard for me to learn. And being a boss does not come naturally to me. I think people should just do their jobs, like having conversations, being like, oh my God, like you're not doing your job. Those are so painful. Like, and I have to rev myself up for that stuff so much. But I've gotten better at it. And then also I've been able to make more, like we have a million pages on our website that are like policies. So instead of having to make micro decisions every time of like, oh, what do I feel about that? I'm like, nope, we have a policy. I'm going to send you the link to our policy. And that's our policy, you know? And so taking those like kind of day-to-day brain decisions off of my, you know, my plate has been essential for me in getting better.
But that takes a lot of work to write those policy. I'm in the, you know,
yeah. Oh, it's awful. Yeah.
It takes a lot of work and it takes a lot of time behind the scenes. It's not something that the public sees or anybody else sees in terms of a business model. It's all behind the scenes work to make the presentation out to the public seamless. Yeah.
So but even the Write for Us page that I shared there, you know, for years, people would be like, I want to write for the Plaid Horse. How do I do it? And then I would like craft them an email or respond to them or, you know, and it just took so much out of me. And then, I mean, we only came up with that Write for Us page like a year or two ago, which is so many years into this, but now I shoot out that link, you know, 20 times a day, you know, and then it's not like explaining, it's not all this stuff. And so we have some successful initiatives that are like, that keep us going in making those pages, because that link alone has saved me hundreds of hours in the last year.
Absolutely. So how many people do you employ now?
Most people do something else also. And that's not a reflection of the magazine as much as I think it's a reflection of we've always been remote, and it's hard for people to work 100% from home. And so the pandemic shifted some stuff up a little bit. We've actually had a couple of people who are part-time, moved into full-time, and then asked to go back to part-time so that they could keep going to an office 1 or 2 days a week for another job. Because it's, you know, I think a lot of parents, when they're home with their kids all the time, you know, that ends up being, you know, harder on them. And you know, you just kind of get a break from different aspects of your life. It's really creative work, and you know how exhausting creative work is. And I think there are very few people who want to be creative for 40 hours a week. I mean, there are a lot of people who think they do, but when push comes to shove and it's like produce creativity, that's hard. And I think a lot of people thrive at producing creativity for 20 hours a week or 25 hours a week. And so we mostly have people that are more on that track. You know, I'm not opposed to more people like doing things differently, but I try to go with what people want. Like, people know how they're going to be successful. I know how I'm going to be successful. And so it's really more of a conversation of like, how do we set you up for success? So we have about a dozen people that are on kind of that 20 to 30 hour a week, plan, and a lot, you know, some of them horse show a lot. And, you know, and that's kind of what they have to fit in, or, you know, have families, or, you know, have different things that they don't want to give up. And I respect that. So
it's great. Because that's kind of what I've been doing, is looking for people. No one's full-time, everybody's part-time, but everybody does what they do best. Yep. And so it's just finding people that fit in the model and just keep plugging them in and letting them do their jobs. And that's what I love, is you do your job and you do it well. I don't need to do it. And when did you, so the magazine itself, I know you at Equine Affair, do you have a final count on how many magazines you handed out?
It was in like I want to say it was in the like 11,000 range. Like, literally by the end of Equine Affair, like, I couldn't even move my thumb because I'd made this gesture of like handing out the magazine so many times that I was like,
because I kept watching, and you were sort of a little on the angle from where my booth was, and the table would be full of magazines, and then I'd look over and it would be empty, and then the table would be full of, and then it would be empty. And this went on for 3 days, and it was just 4 days. It was crazy. It was so much fun to watch. And it's why I walked over and I went, you know, I need to know who you are and what's going on here. So the magazine itself is free, the print magazine.
So I looked at there are a lot of things that I, by not having a background in marketing and not having a magazine background, I looked at a lot of things differently out of the gate than other people do. And I think part of that is why we've been successful, is because I've just looked very rationally at pieces. And I think we're at a stage where people don't want to pay for content. They can get it free online, so they're not really going to pay. And I always just looked at it as like, mainstream magazines are like supposedly serving their advertisers and they're selling ad space. And then they're also serving their subscribers. So they're keeping everything gated and waiting for subscriptions. And that just felt wrong to me. Like, either you're serving your advertisers or you're serving your subscribers. So we always took the model of we're serving our advertisers. And so we have subscriptions, and we have plenty of subscriptions. If you want to receive every issue in print to your house, shipped, you know, you can, and plenty of people do that. If you want to just receive a copy sporadically and read it, it's available at horse shows and tack shops at places like Equine Affair. We always want to bring new people in. I mean, we got so many people who then did subscribe from Equine Affair. And then all the advertisers pick specific issues because of where it might be given out and where they might get new people. And we always need new people in this sport. So we have advertisers pick that issue because they want to be distributed at Equine Affair. And they know their ad's going to be there, and they know we're going to have plenty of magazines out. And so at the end of the day, if given the choice, I always serve advertisers, and I want as many eyeballs on those ads as possible. I'm an educator. I believe in education. The entire issue, every issue is free online. So if you want to just go read every issue online and never subscribe, like, welcome, you know, come read, come learn, come look at the ads, come be eyeballs for our advertisers. That's great too. And so
What I loved about your magazine when I opened it was, even though there's advertising, you know, some magazines you can't open without feeling it's all advertising and these little tiny columns of text, right? But when I open your magazine, it's, I have to say, it's beautiful. I don't know who your layout person is, but it's beautifully laid out. It's beautifully printed. It's lovely paper. You know, I mean, all those are qualities as a writer and an author I look at and go, wow, you know, I mean, there's nice white space. And the articles are, there's a lot of articles. So it's really, you serve your advertisers, but you serve your readership. And that's what I loved about it when I looked at it. And I was like, wow, you're not just, you know, ad after ad after ad, even though that's your model. So, and then the content, do you have like, I've forgotten the word, you know, like a plan throughout the year of what the content is? Obviously you're covering horse shows and not just, hunters, right? You cover all different disciplines.
Yep. And we welcome submissions from everything. So every issue has a theme. February, we just put out as a stallion issue. So it's full of stallions, breeders, young horses. Every issue has a little bit of everything. And then the theme is on top of it. We have some style and fashion issues. We have the horse care issue. We have the pony issue, which is, you know, obviously my mothership. We have, equitation, indoors, education. So every issue has a theme, but every issue has something for everyone in it. We try to build around that theme. So we have regular columns. One of our really popular columns is called It Happens, where professionals or big name people share times where things just, everything went wrong in the ring, and they're all, because it happens to everyone. And they're all hilarious and relatable. And then sometimes we'll try to get that on theme with what the issue theme is. So the It Happens and the pony issue is generally like disasters that happen to people at pony finals. And, you know, it's so much fun because we all have these stories. And so,
it makes everybody real.
Yep. Yep. Mm-hmm. And that's what I want. And I want to educate people. And that's why we put so much effort into our articles. Like, you know, the point of the plaid horse is not to make money. I mean, the advertisers sustain the educational mission to grow the sport.
Which is really awesome. You know, and you started out talking about, so I grew up in Hunters, but I was the poor kid with, you know, the backyard horse, and I was right next to Oxridge, you know, and I'd go and watch Oxrids and that sort of thing. And so, you know, I totally can relate to the fat shaming and the, you're either in or you're out, you know, you didn't have the right lining in your coat, you know. Sadly, that was in a long time ago, and it sounds like that's still part of that world. But you know, it sounds to me like one of your missions is to see if we can overcome that, see if we can move beyond this stereotypical type of person that's supposed to be the perfect rider and et cetera.
Yeah, and I think a lot of stuff is, you know, I think it goes both ways. Number one, like one of the reasons I come to work is because I do see it changing and I do see things moving in a positive direction. And I do think people are better. We have our plaid horse adult amateur lounge where everyone is really supportive of everyone. And it's a community, you know, on Facebook where people post all the time and find these positive things. I think if you go into any situation expecting the worst or expecting people to be awful, like you'll find it. And I think the hunters do suffer from some of that. Is like, I think you get out of the car and you're like, oh my God, am I going to be fat shamed? And then someone says something like innocuous, like, oh, what'd you get for lunch? And you're like, ah! That's real. Like we've all been there. You know, I think that's like very, you know, there's so many very real things going on here. I think that's what, you know, a lot of stuff that we can, you know, kind of navigate through. And if we can have people have expectations more set up for success, I think that's part of the situation that will help this. If we can have people actually be nicer, that's a huge part of it too. And if we can just really talk to people about using better language, like I think a lot of this is unintentional, but if you're, you know, I think a lot of us have, you know, like PTSD to some extent from when we were children, from when people actively like yelled at us that we were fat. So then something as an adult, someone says something really innocuous and we're like, that hits something that really hurts. And so I think the more we can help heal people, help coping mechanisms, and just like even, you know, we had an article about like, why do we wear white and tan breeches? Like that's stupid and inaccessible. And I'm right there too. Like no adult woman like really wants to have like tight, light pants. Like it's just unnecessary. So like, yeah, if we could go fight the good fight about all this stuff, you know, let's do it. And, you know, I think there's so many manners and I said, as I said in the beginning, I don't think that I learned many coping mechanisms growing up in this sport. And I think the more we can emphasize, and this is like what I believe for my horses too, the more my horses can have coping mechanisms, acceptable coping mechanisms on how they handle their jobs. And like, you know, it's not like my horse isn't allowed to spook if something startles him, you know, but like once he spooks, he's expected to, you know, come back to the walk or whatever gate we're doing and continue on his job, you know? Whereas like, you know, you're not allowed to like spook and run around the arena four times, you know, that's not an acceptable coping mechanism. You know, spook and come down to the walk. Sure. You know, that happens sometimes. So I think really being realistic with our kids and our horses about how, what, you know, bad stuff does happen, you know, unexpected stuff does happen. Like we can handle it.
Yeah. And so, you know, I mean, I taught Pony Club for years and I actually went through 4-H when I was a kid. And I have to say that I'm so grateful to my 4-H leader. She was such a model of just behavior and modeling good behavior and way to cope. And so I really attribute that to her. But I also know that in the hunter world, you know, there it can get very, you can get very isolated. Mm-hmm. And so bringing a sense of camaraderie and we're all in this together because we all love the horse, as opposed to, you know, I'm with this trainer and you're with that trainer and, you know, that whole isolationist perspective. I just think it's really great. So you have the Plaid Horse magazine and someone just said, I picked up a copy at Devon Horse Show a few years ago, 2017 or 18, but thought it was more for kids. I don't remember why I got that impression, but I'll check it out again. So great. Yeah. So you've got the magazine, but that's not the only thing you do. Because there were other things on that table that just blew me away. So when did you start writing books and how did all that get going and who are they for? And tell us about that.
So like most things, like a lot of things I ask other people to do like 100 times. And then when they don't, I'm like, oh, I guess I'll have to do it. I loved reading all the books growing up. I read all of them. I loved them. But I really didn't, when I looked back on them as an adult, I really felt like most of them bullied one character. Frequently, we bully that one character for being rich. You know, if you read The Saddle Club through like a slightly different light, you have like kind of the three girls who are friends ganging up on the one girl, you know, and like at the time it was like, well, she's rich and she's mean and that's okay. And I kind of looked back at that as an adult and I was like, here's this other kid that's the same age as them that's hurting. And then the three of them are bullying, you know, ganging up on her all the time. And like, of course she lashes out. And, you know, and that's just like a little bit of an example, but that's kind of the rhetoric I still saw in adults at the barn. And I was like, mm-hmm. We need to, you know, change this so that, you know, and put better role models in for current time. And this is nothing, you know, the first Saddle Club book came out in 1988. Like, I think it stands the test of time. Amazing in so many aspects. It teaches, you know, it talks a lot about responsibility and horse care and, you know, saving up for things at the barn and not being able to afford all the things you want. And there's so many issues they do well, but I just thought that we needed an update for, you know, today's world where we have a little more empathy for everyone, regardless of their circumstances. And so I really wanted to have something that, and then I've read a ton of horse books too, that like are super dramatic, like people die and horses die and parents die. And I'm like, that's also just, you know, I get it. Like lots of books are really dramatic, but I didn't want that either. And so I was like, how can we have books that are like really modeling the behavior that we want in the barn? And the behavior we want in the barn is that everything is hard and everything sucks sometimes, but we can work together. And we don't need it to be any harder than that. You know, we already have our horses who are like actively, you know, trying to get hurt all the time and not wanting to do this or that. And it's really hard to ride in a straight line at any gate. So we don't need anything, you know, else. And so really just start to address this stuff at the barn, or, you know, have conflict where people said the wrong thing or put their foot in their mouth and then fix it, you know, and have adult conversations and not like hate the other person forever. So Show Strides has really grown out of that. It's a middle grade reader series, target age, like 8 to 13. Obviously we get adults and people of all ages reading it and love it. One of the things I love is how many parents say that they read it together with their child out loud. And then it kind of opens the doors to having more discussion points. Like, we talk about, in one of the books, one of the girls goes to the tech store and the woman working at the tech store makes a little comment that she's, you know, maybe a little more boxy figure. And she's young. And like, that's what we're seeing now. I mean, girls are starting to feel self-conscious at age 6, you know, they're yeah. starting to, you know,
Instagram the number of, helped.
Yeah, nothing has helped. And so like, I talked to a mom whose daughter is, you know, more athletically built like that. And she was like, you know what, it really opened, you know, we read that scene together. And then it was like, oh, someone in my book is having the same issue that I did, and look at how she handled it. And then they opened the door for the mom to have a conversation with the daughter, you know, about being athletically built and how you can still be a great rider. And like, it doesn't change anything. And, you know, just like the girl in the book rides great.
And say the name of the books again.
The Show Strides book series.
The Show Strides.
Yep. They're on Amazon and on our website. They're on Audible and Kindle too. So way you like to read, it's up to you. We have some parents of younger kids too that get it on Audible and in print so that their child can start to read and have it read to them.
So who reads them on Audible?
Oh, I do. Yeah.
You do. Yep. Awesome. Yep. Okay, great. Cause yep. I've decided that Audible is the way for me to go. I used to yes. love to read, but now I listen to books. So the reader is always so important to me because, you know, they can really make or break a book. And so yep. since it's your book, I think that's fantastic. And how many have you written? Cause I know that there was a bunch on the, yep. they all disappeared.
Yep. Yep. There are 4 out so far. And then book 5 is coming out this year. So our goal is to have 1 out a year come out in the fall every year in time for Christmas.
Oh, wow. Okay. So there's 4. And what are the titles of the 4 books that are already out?
Book 1 is School Horses and Show Ponies. Book 2 is Confidence Comeback. Book 3 is Moving Up and Moving On. And book 4 is Testing Friendships. And I think book 5, we haven't totally decided, but I think book 5 that comes out this year is going to be called Packer Pressure.
Oh, wow. And so basically, these are stories about girls, right?
Involved. Boys too. Yep. Okay. They, girls yep. and boys everybody's involved. At the barn. Everybody gets along.
Awesome. And so they're, you know, it's so nice to know that there are books for young people where they can actually relate to the story, where they can relate to the characters in the story and have an experience, something like that. And that you get the parents involved, or the parents get involved, it sounds like, just because of the content and because of their kids at the barn. And you know, nowadays, I think, you know, when I grew up, we had other kind of pressures. You know, we used to like have to have, you know, air, we used to have to go in the basement of the school to practice for when the bombs might drop and stuff. I'm dating myself. But, you know, it's such a different pressure for kids nowadays. And I, you know, I don't have children, but when I read about some of the things that are going on and how difficult it is, it's really nice to know that there's something out there that can make them feel inclusive and supported.
Absolutely. And I went, you know, I did the whole like Brené Brown, like shame experience thing a couple of years ago with my friend. Like we read all the books and we like processed it all together and worked together on our own shame. And I had no idea how much like my own shame in this sport was dictating my decision-making and how I interacted with people. And I think like anyone who wants to be a perfectionist, you know, I mean, we all know, like, you know, we've all felt in our face when it just burns when we make a mistake, you know, and I think really like getting to the root of that stuff for me was huge. And that was my personal big hiccup in achieving more. And I know that, you know, everyone has their own thing, but like, you know, finding your way through whatever that thing is that's really, you know, keeping you from where you want to be. And whether that's, you know, whether that's shame or fear or bravery, or, you know, I think we can practice skills way more than we give ourselves credit for. And we can practice reactions, and, you know, we can practice being brave. We can practice not feeling shame. We can practice, you know, overcoming so many things. And I'm not saying that it's ever going to be perfect. And I don't think that, you know, I'm, you know, like I've been doing so well for a while. And then like yesterday, like it was like one of those, like, so stupid, but like, you know, something happened and then I called someone and they didn't call me back. And I was like, oh my God, they hate me. Like I screwed everything up, you know? And, but like being there in the moment and like identifying of like, no, this is like how my body wants to react to something and how my brain wants to react to something, but this is not the rational reaction to them being at a horse show and not answering one phone call. You know, and because I've practiced that, I was able to say that to myself. And, you know, I think there's so many aspects of this sport that we can practice. And, I was in Wellington last month and I saw one of my friends and she read something I wrote and she was like, I had no idea that like you were so afraid as a rider, like that you were so timid about stuff. And I was like, yeah. And, you know, she had read something that a piece that I had written about that. And she looked at me and she goes, you know, if you're that afraid and you show up and you ride anyways, you must really love it. And I was like, you know, I do. And it was like, it totally reframed things in like, in one statement. I was like, yes, like anyone who is afraid and shows up and rides anyways, really loves it. Like, welcome. Like, that's awesome. We have this in common. Like, and anyone who X is hard for them because of Y and shows up anyways, like that's a behavior I want to lionize, and I want to be part of our sport going forward.
You know, it's really awesome to listen to you. You know, it just, there's so many things in what you're saying that are so important for people to hear. And your honesty with your own experience is really, I want to thank you for that, because, you know, it makes it real. It's not just someone else. It's our own personal experiences. And, you know, I've had a lot of my own personal experiences in this industry and growing up in it and being around it for a long time. And one of the things that I find when I teach, because that's been my job for 30 years, is how important it is to help people feel that they can do something and they have the skills and to not worry if they don't get it perfect. And I think in the past, or at least in other teaching, you know, you have someone who tells you what you're supposed to do, and you're so busy trying to figure out what you're supposed to do, you're not riding, you're not on your horse, you're not there. And, you know, I'm always giving my students permission to experiment and to do things and going back and forth and listen to the horse. But that's, you know, when I started doing that, that was definitely not the norm. And I don't know how much it is in the teaching today, just because I, you know, I kind of live in my own little bubble over here. But, you know, that fear of making a mistake, that fear of doing it wrong, that fear of messing up your horse is one of the things that I find so strong in the industry. I'm going to make a mistake. I'm going to screw up my horse, you know? I always tell my students, as soon as you think that you've done it, right? The biggest screw up is worrying about screwing up, because you're gonna, I mean, that's just a given. Nobody's perfect. I have things I've done. Boy, do I just wish I could take it back, but I learned from the experience. You know, and that's such a valuable lesson, is that, okay, we're not perfect. We're going to make mistakes. And the most important thing is to learn from the experience and figure out another way to do it. Horses have been such a model, obviously in your life and in my life, for living, for being, you know, dealing with things and coping with things and struggling and overcoming. When I see parents that say, I'll never forget this one kid, and I'll just tell this quick story so we can get back. But, you know, this kid just hung ringside and she stared at the horses and she'd done some riding. And then her parents decided that soccer was how she was going to win her scholarship to college. And they stopped her riding. And I've never forgotten this kid who so loved riding. And the message I always have for parents is, make sure that you follow the thing your child has passion about. And clearly you have a ton of passion about horses and riding, and that's what you're doing, is following your passion and your love.
Absolutely. And, you know, and the scholarship stuff is like, you know, that's its own whole thing. But like, I think a lot of parents that obsess over that, you know, that just like people who obsess over, you know, arbitrary goals for their horses, that's where injuries come in. That's where over, you know, not liking it anymore. And all that stuff, burnout, all of those things come in when, you know, when you do that. Like, this is, if you want the most economical model for your child going to college, you should spend sticker price on college and not have your child do any sport. I mean, the amount you have to soccer and riding, everything, the amount that you have to spend in every sport to get that scholarship is like a fiscal irrationality. So, you know, figure out what makes sense, but like doing any sport to get the scholarship is a financially irrational decision in any sport.
Wow. Well, and also, you know, the chances of injury and everything else. I mean, it's such a small percentage that actually make it that way. But I agree with you. If you're going there for an education, that's what you should be focusing on. I gave up my horse during my college education because I couldn't do both. Yep. And so that was a hard decision, but an important decision so that I could focus. Yeah. So, okay. So you've got the magazine. It comes out every single month.
It comes out 9 times a year. So we can buy in a couple months. Yep. Yep.
Okay. All right. 9 times a year. You've got the books and then you've got the website.
Yep.
And then you've got all the social media that goes along with that.
Yep. We have a weekly podcast, the Plaidcast.
The Plaidcast. And what kind of topics do you have on your podcast?
Pretty much everything. It's just like the magazine. I want to show people that their careers that are not sitting in a saddle or standing next to a jump. So we have a lot of people who have horse industry kind of off the beaten path careers, whether it's vendors or designers or, you know, like everything, blacksmiths, that, you know, everything you can think of.
Your job counseling too.
Yep. Yep. Oh yeah. Yep. And then I teach a college course that's online. It's over the summer and open to everyone through Clarkson University. About equestrian business and how to get the most out of this industry, and how to think about things, how to set up your books, you know, going through the different economics of various things in the sport. So those are over the summer. So I think.
Yeah. Well, I had Julie Broadway from the American Horse Council come on, you know, and she was talking about the size of the industry. And so often people think that if they want to be around horses, there's only two career paths, right?
Yep. Yep.
But there's so many career paths that are in association with horses to be in the industry, to be outside, to be your own boss. It's really amazing. So then this leads me to ask you, since you're teaching courses on business in horses, right? Essentially.
Yep.
Did you have a coach? How did you learn all this stuff? Was it just like trial and error?
It's a lot of it was trial and error. And then, you know, with my friends, they're trial and error and watching all of this stuff. So my parents both have a very large business background. So like, you know, stuff for me, like both of them were on the faculty at Wharton. So like,
oh, wow.
As economics professors. Yes. So like economics is always like dinner table discussion. And then what I realized is like, they would tell me stuff as a child and I'm like, that doesn't apply to my business. And they're like, what do you mean? It doesn't apply to your business. And I'm like, that doesn't apply to my business. And so there was like a lot of debate and stuff at our like kitchen table when I was like 14 and telling them that they didn't know economics. But in the years since then, actually a number of papers have come out on a lot of the issues that I've talked about. So, you know, these luxury markets behave in a certain way and repeat business models. And so a lot of this stuff I was actually right on, but they did the research in mainstream economics kind of hadn't caught up with me. And so that's one of the things, you know, some of the things I love to teach is because like, these are actually peer-reviewed economics papers. These are now economics principles. And all kinds of stuff, like what the incentives are. And so like I love to confront things that people think it might be one thing and it's actually the other thing. So two of the things that I'm, you know, that we confront in the class are like, are you better off buying or leasing? And some people are like, well, basically I want to buy because I want to own equity at the end. But like, if you're in a traditional trainer setting, and you're, you know, your trainer's helping you shop, once you go through, you know, throwing random numbers out there and it changes over different numbers. But if you look at a $50,000 horse versus a $15,000 a year lease, which horses generally lease for about a third of their value, when you buy a horse for $50,000, you're paying the commission on that full price. If you lease for $15,000, you're paying the commission once, and then you lease the horse for whatever period of time, a year, and then you give it back. Well, if you buy the horse for $50,000, you're paying the commission on the purchase, and then you're going to pay the commission again on the other side on the sale, and you know, in fluctuations in value. And once you get through the risk and all of these various things, at that specific price point, you actually spend more money selling, I mean, buying and selling the horse than you do for leasing it for the year. And so many people, you know, the instinct is to be like, oh, leasing, I'm flushing money down the toilet. Like, I want to own the horse. You know, and there are so many factors, and if you have specific goals and your lease terms wouldn't let you do this and you want to do that, like there's so many ways to look at it, but there's so many things in this industry that like your instinct is to be like, this is wrong. And then it's actually like, or like, I'm going to breed my own horse.
Oh, please don't do that.
Yeah, no, don't do that. Like going through the economics of every one of these scenarios and saying, you know, this is what works. This is what, you know, doesn't work. These are factors you haven't thought of, you know, and bringing different things to the table like that, and really just pencil the paper running through the numbers. And a lot of people don't do that.
No, they react emotionally, and that's, you know, all decisions are irrational, right? In the end, they're all irrational. However, if we can arm ourselves with some, like you say, pen and paper, and sit down and actually work the numbers, then we can at least make an educated, irrational decision instead of an uneducated, irrational decision.
Yep. And then, you know, I find that people get obsessed with pre-purchase exams, and, you know, pre-purchase exams have a time and a place, and I'm not, you know, saying don't do it, but like, a pre-purchase exam is an evaluation of risk. It is not any more or less than that. And it's an evaluation of risk on the day you do it. And so, you know, expectations that that horse will last or won't last. I mean, if you have like a lot of these things, we're talking about statistics. And if you have one animal, statistics don't apply to you. You know, at the end of the day, like if you look at that bell curve, if you own 100 animals, statistics apply to you. But like, if you own one animal, you could be anywhere on that bell curve and like nothing actually applies to you. And it was interesting. So like for ponies, the height is really important. You know, they want to be 12-2, 13-2 or 14-2 to do the pony hunters. And, you know, and that has so many factors, some of which are rational, some are irrational, but at the end of the day, that's what the market wants. And so I was talking to someone the other day who wants to breed one pony. And she's like, now what height can I expect? And I'm like, you know, no, like, I was like on the bell curve, if we bred 100 ponies this year, most of them would be the right height. But like, if you're going to breed one pony, like,
it might not be a pony when you're done.
It might not be a pony. It might not be anything like, so just having the expectations of like what data does and doesn't apply to you. The fact that the plural of anecdote is not data, and we do not have a ton of data to work with in our sport. Another misconception I see a lot of people having is I call it the repeat business model. Issues understanding repeat business models. So sometimes people say to me like, oh, I want to buy a pony from a nice family. I don't want to buy a pony from a dealer. And I'm like, okay, so the nice family is selling one pony ever in their lives. And if you look at game theory, they're incentivized to get every dollar they can for that pony. And if you are the right or wrong person to purchase that particular pony, they're not incentivized and probably don't have the knowledge to tell you if you're the right or wrong person. Whereas a dealer is working on a repeat business model. If you buy one from the dealer and you don't come back next year to buy another one from a dealer, or tell your friend that you bought one from the dealer and you had a good experience and they come back next year, the dealer's out of business. This is their bread and butter. This is their livelihood. So the dealer actually has less incentive to be dishonest with you than the nice family with one pony. The dealer has less incentive to price gouge you than the nice family with one pony, if we're playing this by game theory. And so like, and that's something I hear a lot is like, oh, I don't want to buy from the large conglomerate evil dealer. I mean, but at the end of the day, there's a reason people come back over and over and over. And if you have a problem buying one from a dealer, most of them will make something better. I'm not going to say they're going to make it right or give you your money back, but they will make something better. They will make some concession. They will sell the horse for you. They will do something. The dealer will help you out if there is an issue. The private family, you call them back 6 months later, you know, what are they going to do? And they don't even, and it might not even be malicious. They just don't have the inventory. So like the trainer I partner with my ponies, sells or leases about 125 ponies every year, as she has for the last 10 years. So like, if you have an issue with your pony, she has inventory sitting there to make it right. Like, you know, and so you get a lot of different market incentives than people want to consider emotionally out of the gate.
You know, there are so many of these sort of misconceptions in the industry that we've drug forward from years and years, you know, and it's really nice to see that we're starting to put some hard facts and science behind it. From my perspective, what we have never done is define a good rider position. There is no definition of good. It's whatever anybody decides this is good because the horse has done X, Y, or Z, as opposed to what we do in all the other sports, which is analyze their function and analyze them in wind tunnels and, you know, with machines and everything else and decide this is a better way to perform. We don't have that in our industry. It sounds like that's starting to come in terms of what you're doing with buying and selling and that sort of thing. And I know we're starting to move in that direction when it comes to, you know, looking at equipment fit and measuring pressures. Mm-hmm. And we're doing that with feet, which is great. You know, we're still struggling with saddles. but, you know, that and the rider position, from my perspective, is if we could put more science behind it, more understanding of good function, we would have so many fewer horses that, you know, have problems because the rider is riding functionally well in a definition that we can all agree upon. I don't know that it'll ever happen.
Yeah. I mean, and I do think that that's hard given that we are the only sport where like all sizes, shapes, body types, genders compete equally in our literally equal, you know, and so I think that position, everyone's center of balance is, I mean, you think about like in basketball, there is, you know, an ideal physique, you know, there's an ideal whatever. And so I think that's.
Yeah, but you have all different size basketball players, right? And they still all can perform in a function that's effective. Right. And that's what I'm talking about. It's absolutely, you have to take in consideration, you know, different body shapes and types. And like, I always talk about upper arm length. People with really short upper arms have been yelled at forever to get their hands down and they can't, not like a person with a long arm, you know?
Yep.
And so it's such a misconception. And yet these people are shamed for having a short upper arm because their hands won't be in the same position as a long arm person. And, you know, and that's the kind of thing I'm talking about is that we decide that they're incapable, but we never look at what's going on that's causing that problem and then adjust to a physical line, you know, a line of physics that's going to work versus this is where your hands have to be. And that's the kind of, you know, piece that I'm talking about is, you know, how can we work toward that? But hopefully it's, you know, the industry is changing. I'm really glad to hear about the changes in the hunter world. Cause I grew up in hunters. That was where I started. But I've been out of that for quite a long time. So it's really nice to see that you're there. And like you say, fighting the good fight and educating people. And certainly with all your books and everything, it's fantastic. I just, you know, we're getting close to the end of the hour. I just want to ask if anybody has any questions for Piper, just pop them in the chat. You guys have been super quiet over there, which is great. And my bangs are driving me crazy. I got to go to the hairdresser. where are you going next? Do you have some plans? What's your goals?
Yep. I'm in California for the winter circuit. So I brought out my two horses. So we'll see how that goes. I'm going to try to show a little bit. I have Ruben, I've had him for 3 years and he's my heart horse. He just,
I was going to say, as soon as you started talking about him, your everything changed. It was awesome.
Yep. Yep. He's weird. He failed out of the show circuit with a lot of people and he wants to do things his own way. And so we love him and we love him for that. So we just kind of do what he wants and it's gone really well. And then I got to catch ride a horse 6 years ago that I fell in love with and I've been trying to get ever since. And I was able to get him recently. So, and he is a fierce competitor, and I'm just really excited. So I haven't shown him back now yet. So I haven't shown him in 6 years. And so we're just gonna take things slow and see how it goes.
Awesome. Awesome. And for the magazine and for your business, is there, do you have like goals for 2022?
Yep. So Show Strides book 5 coming out is one of the big goals. We're kind of looking at if we can have Show Strides come out in Espanol, or, you know, ways that we can be more inclusive with that kind of stuff. We have a book coming out, a training manual with purpose. And that's about Balmoral, tracing Carlton Brooks. So that'll be coming out this year, and that'll come out on Audible as well, which I'm really excited about. And yeah, more podcasts, more articles, more pushing on every front. We'll have 9 issues of the magazine. I'm teaching my college courses this summer. So yeah, just a lot of like keeping on, and keeping everything moving and growing.
Awesome. Awesome. So I'm just going to ask this question. Are you familiar with Surefoot at all? Have you seen it or yeah?
Yep. Ruben's actually barefoot.
Awesome.
He has shown at the biggest shows all over the country. And he's actually barefoot. And so we have this great female farrier in Wisconsin who makes a plan for all of mine, and she uses Surefoot.
Awesome. That's great. Yep. But you don't have a pair for him, do you?
He doesn't have a pair now.
Well, maybe we need to send you out a pair.
Okay.
Send me your address, where you are in California. I'll send you out a pair of ferns, and we'll see if he likes that. And that may help you with your training.
Awesome.
That'd be great. All right. Well, thanks everybody for joining us. So we've got, research into horse behavior and welfare and body mechanics of horse and rider separately and together have some insight into more efficient rider position, but the traditional is still rule most. Yes, that's actually true. And thank you. Would you show your video one more time? Okay, yes, I will show my video to end on this snowy day. I will, I got to cue it up. Hang on. I've got to figure out where I put it. Let me just close that, but I will show Al rolling one more time here if I can figure out where the heck it went. I know where it was. Let me just make it big. There we go. Now I have to get back to screen share. Do share screen. Do. Hang on. I'm running into, I can do this. Keep talking while I'm sorting out my pony. Here we go. Now I've got it. So this is just what it looks like today in Virginia. There we go. Here's Big Al. And of course, you know, Dunny has to come over. Dunny is the pest. And I like, he bites out in the jump up button at one point here too. It's just right there is grabbing him. All right, so everybody roll over and have a fantastic day. And we'll see you all on Thursday. We're gonna talk about how to be a Surefoot practitioner. So join us then. And thank you, Piper. It's really great to hear what you're doing. Keep up the good work. It's fantastic.
Thank you for having me. Thanks everyone.
Bye.